Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A return to normalcy today, two guests, two segments. We'll hear from Vijay Prashad in an interview keyed in part to May Day, and then from Becca Rothfeld, who thinks things are too small. Before that, a few words in the news. Regular listeners know that I'm no fan of Trump's tariffs. Tariffs can be useful in small, targeted doses if you're trying to build up a new industry. This is especially true for poorer countries, though it's possible to imagine a rich country like the U.S. using them as part of a reindustrialization strategy. But tariffs alone won't do the trick. You need a serious industrial policy as well, meaning serious planning to make it work. Trump's tariffs will just raise prices and lead to a sharp fall in imports of products that we just don't make here, from tchotchkes to sophisticated electronics. On Wednesday, the first take on first quarter GDP came out, reporting the first decline since the COVID quarters. Before that, you'd have to go back to 2014 to find another minus sign. The reason was a surge in imports. In national income accounting, imports are treated as a subtraction for GDP, which were quickly stockpiled in advance to the tariffs. Exports were weak. But it wasn't just that. Spending on durable goods, appliances, vehicles, things designed to last a while, declined after adjusting for inflation. Trump says better days are ahead, but with tariffs beginning to bite and shipping traffic to the U.S. in steep decline, we're going to see soaring prices, bare shelves, and layoffs within weeks. Trump says it's Biden's fault, of course, but it's not clear how. My first guest is Vijay Prashad, Executive Director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which describes itself as an international institute guided by popular movements and organizations. We, meaning they, seek to build a bridge between academic production and political and social movements in order to promote critical thinking and stimulate debates and research with an emancipatory perspective that serves people's aspirations. Vijay grew up in India and then spent many years in the U.S. as a student and later as a professor at Trinity College in Hartford. Tired of the academic life, he threw it over in 2017 to become director of Tricontinental. His interests range widely, from history to culture to political economy. He's a prolific writer with over 20 books to his name, most recently, at least I think it's his most recent, it's hard to keep up, on Cuba, co-written with Noam Chomsky. Apologies for the sound on this. It was recorded not with my usual setup, but with WhatsApp, and Vijay, amusingly, was using one of Elon Musk's Starlink satellites for his connection, so it lacked audio excellence. Vijay Prashad.
First, let's talk about the state of the American empire. Trump is certainly a principle of turmoil. What do you make of what's going on?
Well, he might be a principle of turmoil, but there is a logic underneath everything that he's doing. I mean, it's an old adage, short-term pain, long-term gain. I think that's the strategy that they are pursuing, which is to say they think they want to inflict damage on China's rise, and they feel like this is the strategy to use to do it. And if they don't do it, even though it inflicts short-term pain, even on U.S. capital and perhaps standing in the world, if they don't do this and don't inflict some damage on China, it's going to be too late. In fact, you know, we are at another phase of the who lost China debate. In 1949, when the revolution happened, there was a big purge in the U.S. State Department. People are upset. Who lost China? Who wasn't keeping an eye on the ball? Amongst the Trump right-wing realists like Elbridge Coolby, they are really worried about China's rise, and they think if they don't hit China hard now, it's going to be too late. So there's a logic in this madness. It's not completely, you know, chaos. They, I think, understand what they're doing. Whether this is going to work, that's another separate issue.
They're eviscerating America's support for the universities. They're eviscerating research in the U.S. That's not a way to compete with China in the technological sphere.
Well, but on the other hand, they could come back and make the argument. And by the way, it's not just Trump. My favorite capitalist newspaper is the Financial Times. And the Financial Times had an editorial criticizing Trump's attack on the U.S. universities. But they hedged their bets and say, on the other hand, U.S. universities have gone too far and they've allowed the left too much leeway. They've done too much of this stuff on diversity. In other words, put the focus away from DEI and towards STEM. Enough diversity and inclusion. Let's do more on science and technology. There's a logic underlying this. I don't think it's entirely crazy. Now, again, the second question is, will it work? Well, you're going to chase away all the scientists from Asia. Many of the scientists, you know, from Europe may not come. African scientists, Latin Americans, they're all going to go home. That's not going to be great for training the next generation. But I can see the crazy logic underneath this. I think they do sense that, hey, wait a minute, let's look at patent creation. The Chinese are creating more patents now than scientists in the United States. Not a good sign. I can tell you one thing. Having spent some time in Chinese universities, there are more and more scientists who worked in the U.S. university just picking up their sticks and going back to China, or some of them for the first time moving to China and bringing their labs with them, bringing their technical skills and so on. They don't want to live in a hostile environment. But I can see partly what the logic is, which is that, is there a way to rebuild scientific inquiry at the high level in the U.S., technical capacity, and maybe manufacturing? I just don't think it's going to work, Doug, but I can see the logic.
One of the features of the American Empire since the end of World War II has been the second tier of imperial powers, Western Europe, Canada, Japan. And now they're getting thrown under the bus, and they're really mad at the United States and broken all these ties that went on for decades. What do you make of that internal structure of the empire?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, let's start first with the appearance most recently of Mark Rutte in April in the White House, sitting in the Oval Office beside Trump, where, you know, he basically was on his knees in front of Trump with his hands joined in prayer, as if Trump is the new Pope, you know, and this is the Vatican praying to Trump and saying, you know, we'll do anything. I hope you'll come to The Hague. I want to welcome you to the NATO meeting so that we can make the NATO meeting a great scene of American power. That's what Mark Rutte, former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, now head of NATO, says to Trump. So I don't know how mad the elites are in Europe. I think there's going to be some changes, some maybe hurt feelings here and there. In the end of the day, where do the Europeans have to go, or the Canadians? You know, there's no other place but the effect of being dragged back into whatever new imperial arrangement the United States decides to create. And I think there's a lot of overreading of this, you know, maybe transatlantic rift. I just don't see where the Europeans have. They don't have anywhere to go, okay? Practical-minded people in Europe know that Germany wouldn't last a week in warfare against anybody. Britain doesn't have an army. You know, where are these people without the U.S. nuclear and military cover? Nowhere. They're going to all come back running. Whatever Trump is going to offer, they're going to come back running. Whoever the next president is, they're going to come back running. They have subordinated themselves so fundamentally to the United States since World War II that they really have nowhere to go. You know, they tried to build economic ties with China when the United States snapped its fingers and says, no, take the economic hit because we don't want that. They did exactly what the U.S. said to them, even though it's painful. You know, when the U.S. said, you're not going to buy more energy from Russia, even though that was cheaper, they took the hit. I mean, where are they going to go? I just don't see an alternative for Europe other than to come back home to daddy.
Now, what do you make of how China is reacting? How are they handling Trump? What's their strategy for the long term?
Well, that's the key thing. You just said the phrase, for the long term. That's very, very good that you put that phrase on the table. Because one of the things I've noticed in terms of strategic planning, different countries have absolutely different cultures towards strategic planning. In the United States, typically strategic planning, and even the term planning just sounds, you know, anachronistic in government circles. Strategic planning is on the very short term. You know, they think about about election cycles. They think about how long they're going to remain at their post before they are unilaterally fired from their post. They're not thinking in the long term. You talk to people in Asia, the long term is much longer than an administration. And you talk to people in China, they're thinking 50, 60, 70 years. They are willing to wait out whatever's happening here. I mean, there's a couple of things that I'd like to say directly to that. One, they know that they have built the technological foundation and the scientific foundation. They built that foundation for the next generation of productive forces. I mean, since roughly the last 3 or 4 years, the Chinese government documents all talk about the new quality productive forces. You know, I've visited dark factories in China. They are incredible. It's 100% mechanized factory producing high-tech equipment. It's an incredible sight. I visited a greenhouse. I say greenhouse, Doug, sounds like kitchen gardening. An enormous agricultural factory that produces cherry tomatoes, which is about 80% robotized. They have robots there pruning the vines for the cherry tomatoes. I mean, their quality productive forces are at a different level. Their high-speed rail, different level. They know, they're confident that they can wait this out. As long as they don't get bombed into eternity, they can wait this out. And secondly, their main geostrategic issue is what they call the province of Taiwan. Even there, they know they can wait it out. Unless the United States puts mid-range nuclear weapons in Taiwan, the Chinese are not going to go and invade the island. They are not going to do that. I mean, I think they are going to wait it out. They've seen what happened when the Russians were provoked into Ukraine, and I don't think they want to repeat that.
What do you think their plan for Taiwan is?
Well, it's the plan that they've had for now several years, which is that Taiwan is just part of China. I mean, the entire Taiwanese economy would shut down if China decided to cut off trade with the island. I mean, it is increasingly integrated without the need to making any grand statement. One interesting thing about China, which I think people in the U.S. don't recognize, I don't know any other country in the world that had a former part of their territory taken by colonial power, made into a separate place for 100 years, and then when they incorporate that part of the territory back, they allow it its own constitution. Obviously, I'm talking about Hong Kong. Even India went and invaded with military force Goa, Daman and Diu from the Portuguese in the 1960s and brought it under the Indian constitution. There was no question of having separate laws in Goa and so on. I don't know any other country in the world which has allowed something like Hong Kong. So the Chinese are incredibly patient. You know, they are not people, it seems to me, strategically, I'm talking about strategic patience. They are not in a hurry to go in and sort of incorporate. They know that over time, the enormous centrifugal effect of the Chinese economy and of China in general politically is going to draw Taiwan more and more into China's, into what it was, which is a part of China. So I don't think there's any anticipation. Now, you will meet people who online or elsewhere who will be like, well, we need to go and militarily end this. But I don't think that's the issue from Beijing. Their strategic patience is actually quite incredible.
I'm speaking with Vijay Prashad, Executive Director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research.
You know, as someone who studies the American ruling class as a rotting social formation, just corrupt, stupid, venal, any number of adjectives I could apply, the contrast with China strikes me as remarkable. It seems like a very disciplined, serious ruling class with a vision for where to go over the next century. Our ruling class doesn't have a vision of where to go for the next 2 months.
This is a very interesting thing you've said, because in a sense, the situation of the capitalists in China is something that people have not studied enough. In a way, the Chinese state, which is run by the Communist Party, has never allowed the capitalists in China to be a class. They are not allowed to have a media. They are not allowed to have associations. They are not allowed to operate in any kind of way that gives them class power in a unified sense. There are, of course, capitalists in China, but there's no capitalist class, if you see what I mean.
It's not a bourgeoisie in a classic sense.
It is not a bourgeoisie. We know, for instance, that from the history of bourgeoisies in many places, it takes a very long time for a bourgeoisie to form. They don't get formed just because they have political power. It's a cultural formation. It requires universities where your children study together, and then country clubs, and then it requires chambers of commerce, newspapers, charitable institutions. It requires an enormous cultural project. That cultural project is simply not available. I'll give you an example. Jack Ma of Ant started making some statements a few years ago about, you know, this is what China should do politically. Well, he was immediately told, Mr. Ma, you need to go to this rest house for a few months, perhaps a year. Here's a reading list. Go and read. Then after that, you can come back and we'll see what happens. And that's exactly what happened to him. The Western media was, oh my God, Jack Ma has been disappeared. He was sent to read and study and read, you know, what Chinese history is all about and understand his place in China. Like, you can be a capitalist, but you can't try to interfere in politics or to organize a class. That is just not on. Just a few days ago, a high-level bureaucrat in Xinjiang province was convicted of corruption and sentenced to death. That's what happens there. They are serious people. They don't play around. They don't sentence somebody to death for hunger, which is what happens in capitalist societies run by capitalist classes. There, if you do crimes related to poverty, you might be sentenced to death, or crimes related to mental health issues, you get sentenced to death. You get sentenced to death if you commit crimes of capitalism, corruption. You get sent to study. If you even have the temerity to come out there in public and say, well, this is what we should do politically. Who are you to say anything, Jack? You're just a capitalist. You haven't been a governor of a province and so on. I mean, what's striking in this, Doug, is how poorly people in the West understand the complexity of China today. But not just China, it's other Asian countries as well. The scale, you know, the nature of the ruling classes and so on is very poorly understood.
It's amazing that J.D. Vance the other week was describing the Chinese people as peasants. I mean, he was like 40 years out of date, at least. It seems this is the way the American elite sees China, as just a bunch of rice planters.
I don't know when the last time J.D. Vance has either been to China or seen images of China, but yeah, I mean, I think people would be proud of being called peasants, frankly. They wouldn't see that as an insult. One of the reasons is that they are proud that theirs has been a Chinese revolution led by the peasantry. I don't think they would be unhappy with that. But on the other side, JD, you need to see what Chinese agriculture is today. You know, it's not the agriculture of the 17th or 16th century or even of the 1930s. You know, they have created something interesting, which is a kind of rural-urban development, where in rural areas you have some of the benefits of urban life, but people still farm there. And that's interesting. And I don't know how long that will last, because it's true that in the modern world, the lure of cities is incredible. And people don't want to live in rural areas. They want to move to cities. So the Chinese, like, you know, Hugo Chavez before, you know, was also talking about this. How do you make agriculture something that is not seen as backward? How do you make it something that children want to do? They don't want to escape to the city. These are all complicated sociological questions. They are dealing with this. They are thinking about these things. I mean, interacting with Chinese intellectuals is so interesting. I'm just reading a book by Meng Jie, who teaches economics at Fudan University. I had a very good interaction with him about a month ago. The book is fascinating because he is interested in how competition works in China, and how in this particular case, when high-speed rail was being designed, the Chinese government forced the state-owned enterprises to compete with each other. So a market was created within the state-owned sector.
A situation which the state was always in control.
And the state was always in control. But what's interesting is not just that, and I would love to, you know, come and talk with you about that itself, but what's interesting is that an intellectual at the leading institution in China spends a lot of his time talking to state-owned enterprise bureaucrats and engineers, learning how they're doing capitalism. What I found interesting is meeting these people who are a lot like a combination of Marx's factory inspectors, you know, the reports that he used, and Marx himself, because they are going out there to build actual analysis from the historical actuality of China today. I wish more intellectuals would do that. Like, wouldn't it be interesting if U.S. intellectuals were out there trying to understand how U.S. firms are actually working today and not just writing macroeconomic condemnations of the failures of capital? I mean, I would like to see much more theory built from the actuality of human life. And that's what these people are doing. It's part of that thing you mentioned about the seriousness of people in that part of the world.
Okay, since this is a May Day broadcast, let's switch to the state of the class struggle worldwide. It doesn't look so good for the global proletariat these days. Am I missing something?
Well, you know, the thing is that the global proletariat is in a complicated situation because on the one side, Doug, as you know from Guy Standing, who was the chief economist at the International Labour Organization, we got the term precariat, the precarious proletariat. You know, now that term has been used everywhere. And in fact, the word precarious has become commonplace. It is true that labour contracts have deteriorated. The technology of hiring labor is so sophisticated. I mean, what we think of as like an Uber driver is really a situation for large parts of the working class, a kind of Uberization of the working class. I mean, I live in Santiago, Chile. Everything seems Uberized. You know, there's so much delivery of food and groceries and, you know, everything seems Uber. Labor contracts are Uberized. A lot of people are working through apps. And if not directly through the app, the contracts, even when they get hired, feel like they're Uberized contracts. Very hard to organize the working class into bargaining units when this is the situation where you are basically turned into basically a contracted worker rather than a waged worker or a worker with an actual labor contract. You are like this gig economy situation. Very difficult. And if I can say that reading the ILO documents, the International Labor Organization documents, whenever they come out every few months, it's depressing to see the level of unionization and union density in particular. But one thing is definitely there, is that we have lost the global conversation on this. I mean, the fact that the ILO has descended to pleading for what they call decent work is really quite sad. I mean, where is global leadership for the working class? It's just not happening from anywhere. I just don't see the working class being provided global leadership. You know, and you can't expect countries to do this. This has to come from political parties. It has to come from various entities. I mean, if the UN's labor organization has fallen on its back, who's going to do this? I feel a little bit down on this point, you know, and I just don't see enough intellectuals and journalists covering labor with the kind of intensity that is required.
Now, I could hear the Trotskyist saying, well, this is a task of the working class itself. It has to be grassroots, bottom-up, and not leader-led.
Okay, well, where is that? Let me see your theory in action. Where is that happening? I mean, you can't take one small warehouse somewhere in New York City that is organized by the workers and valorize that to the point where it makes you feel better and think the situation for the global working class is improved. That's just you feeling better, you know, posting something on Facebook saying, yay, you know, Amazon workers have unionized. It's not true. You know, it's not even representative of anything. Where is the working class organizing by itself so easily? I mean, the capitalism always, you know, moves forward, understands how to undermine labor. That's What we learned, not only from Marx's writings, but we learned that from the history of capitalism. Capitalism is not static, it's always in motion, understanding what labor is doing and trying to outwit labor. That's part of the class struggle. It has come to the point where capitalism has designed labor contracts which have made it so hard. I mean, my sister, for instance, worked in a call center where effectively she was sitting at home. She didn't even know the other people that she worked with, you know, and they were all on first name basis. There was no way to communicate with the other workers. How are you going to build a bargaining unit, you know? And also, there is no bargaining unit to be built because there's like 500 workers spread out across the globe with maybe 100 different jurisdictions of work. How are you going to build a bargaining contract? You can't expect this to happen from the bottom up so easily. That is an anachronistic approach to the world. We have to look at it from the actual process of history. This is where we are. How do you expect these workers to build things? You know, they are not going to be able to. You need to think more creatively and differently. I understand that there are some in the trade union movement that have made the return to what is social unionism, where you go and organize people in where they live and so on in working class neighborhoods. I think it's a very productive direction of work to organize people in their neighborhoods. But then what's the power base that you have? You know, is it the municipality which is already underfunded and under attack? You're not able to put pressure on capital if you organize a community organization. So how are we able to inflict worker power over capital? I think these are serious questions that need a lot of study.
Well, I think that the labor arrangements you described really undermine any sense of worker power and worker consciousness. It really does create, firstly, an objective unraveling of social ties within the working class, but also destroys the confidence of the working class in its power to do anything.
Exactly. I mean, I 100% agree. And therefore, you know, the two terms we use a lot in our institute, one is clarity, the other is confidence. Exactly the word you use. There needs to be greater clarity about how the working class is now organized or disorganized or socially, what is the situation of the working peoples of the world. We need clarity about that. We can't base our theory on anachronistic ideas of the world. And secondly, the working peoples of the world need a big boost of confidence. And by the way, it really doesn't help the working peoples of the world to have ultra-leftists smashing and criticizing everything. You know, it's a funny thing. You know, I remember years ago when I was first entering the left movement, one of my comrades said, you know, the most disheartening thing for workers when we go and organize in their living areas is to see two leftists argue outside their door because it's just disheartening and confusing. You have to just take that example of what he said and put it in a much broader way on the internet, you know, where leftists just tear each other apart online, and that in front of working people who look at that and go, that is not my vibe. That is not where I want to put my energy. I'm going to go somewhere else, you know, where people are just not tearing each other apart about minor differences. And that's what the left sometimes does. You don't build the confidence of the working peoples by just attacking everybody and trying to be the smartest person in the room. That's great in a graduate seminar. It's terrible for working class organizing.
That was a historian, journalist, publisher, and think tank director, among his many occupational titles, Vijay Prashad. A statistical footnote to our discussion of J.D. Vance's description of the Chinese population as peasants. According to World Bank data, in 1980, 80% of the country's population was rural. Now it's 35%, a fall of 45 points. Over the same period, India has gone from 77% to 64%, a decline of just 13 points. I don't agree with Vijay's belief that Trump hasn't severely damaged the U.S. empire. Whether that's a good or bad thing is a topic for another time. Something seems broken in the relationship between the U.S. and the second tier of the global imperial structure. Regions like Western Europe, Canada, and Japan, which have long been politically subordinated to the U.S., but which can hardly be described as exploited in some sort of colonial relationship. It's always possible that a Trump successor could repair these ties, but for now they seem to be looking elsewhere. Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, said that the long-standing relationship between the two countries is over, and he's spoken about building a new economic model independent of the U.S. Of course, Canadian nationalists have long dreamed of something like that and failed, but the levels of hostility coming from Trump could give the project a life it never had before. But it's not just our northern neighbor. Germany is leading Western Europe on a rearmament push. And Trump has driven Japan, South Korea, and China, three countries that don't really like each other, into a trade alliance against the U.S. Trump's behavior is causing countries around the world to look to China as a more reliable partner, economically at first, but who knows where that could lead politically. But I may be wrong, and Vijay's point of view is worth listening to. His last point about leftists arguing with each other too much and putting off the masses is excellent. I've been guilty of controversializing on any number of topics over the years, and while I'll confess that it can be fun, it can also be alienating and counterproductive. I'm trying to reform. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Stefan Grappelli's hot jazz version of the Internationale. Before we hear from Becca Rothfeld, another in my series of incoherent sound clips from the venture capitalist and patron of far-right politics, among his protégés J.D. Vance, Peter Thiel. Here he is responding to a question from Piers Morgan about Luigi Mangione, the accused killer of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. The long pauses and false starts are from the original.
And to those who think this shooter is a hero, because he did it because he said this healthcare executive was presiding over a healthcare system which kills thousands of Americans by denying them cover. What would you say to them?
I don't know what to say. I still think you should try to make an argument, and I think this is there may be things wrong with our healthcare system, but you have to make an argument, and you have to try to find a way to convince people and change it by that, and this is not going to work. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of things one could say about it, but I don't think, and I think the motives feel, I don't want to go into all the particulars here, but I don't think there's anything heroic about him.
That was Peter Thiel trying hard to offer a coherent opinion. William Blake said in his Proverbs of Hell that the road of excess leads to the Palace of Wisdom. For Blake, hell was not a site of punishment but a source of energy, unlike the regulated dullness of heaven. My next guest, Becca Rothfeld, would probably agree. Her book, All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess, which was published in hardcover last year, is just out in paperback from Metropolitan Books. As you'll hear, she's had it with minimalism, asceticism, and restraint in art, style, and life. To which I say yes. Becca is the nonfiction book critic for the Washington Post and an errant student of philosophy. Becca Rothfeld.
I was very curious about your essay on fragment fiction and this withdrawal into very small spaces. I guess autofiction is its relative. I'm not quite sure of how these genres work out. But what about this withdrawal into these very small spaces? What do you make of that? What's it all about?
I think that it is of a piece with broader cultural tendencies. Some might call them sort of neoliberal tendencies or tendencies towards homogenization. And that we are kind of being pushed to divest ourselves of all characteristic properties, of all superfluity, and shrink to only what is absolutely necessary. And I think that you see this in sort of cafes that look alike, like everywhere in the world. I think this is an aesthetic that is very common in decluttering manuals, which I, in the essay we're talking about in the book, link with this form of fragment fiction. And I think the aesthetics of that fiction is really borrowing a lot from this imperative to keep what you need and to get rid of excess.
What's the appeal of that, though? It seems very unappealing to me, but I'm old.
I also think that it's quite unappealing, and in fact, that is the thesis of the book, so I do not wish to be taken to be defending this.
I didn't think so, but you know.
but I'm glad to have an opportunity to say why it's so terrible. I think that the thought, the way that it's marketed and pitched pretty explicitly in a lot of these decluttering manuals, is that the less you have, the less physical baggage, but also the less kind of emotional and historical baggage, the easier it will be for you to sort of pick up and go anywhere in the world and replicate your current life. So it makes you somebody who's very appealing maybe to potential employers, which is something that also some of the decluttering gurus say sort of explicitly, that at any moment you can pack up and go anywhere in the world. Yours will be a life of pure beginning.
This is the digital nomad culture, too.
Yes, precisely. I think that there's a strong link between the decluttering people and the digital nomads. And so this aesthetic, more or less explicitly, has been imported, I think, into some contemporary fiction.
Yeah, the parallels between that kind of fiction and Marie Kondo were interesting. That now, I'm attached to my things. I find them expressions of and anchors of selfhood. It's strange that other people seek to be unburdened to that. Do you have any understanding of it, or is it a foreign country to you?
I find it to be pretty much a foreign country, which is why I wrote this book. And I actually think that a lot of the people who are engaging in it find it to be a foreign country, too. Something I mention in the book, and that many people may be lucky not to have witnessed, is that there's an episode of Marie Kondo's TV show where she's helping a woman declutter her house, and the woman's husband has recently died. She's widowed. And she is really reluctant to throw away all of her husband's belongings, understandably. So I think that actually the impulse does not come naturally to her. I think that a lot of the declutterers frame it as a kind of moral and spiritual imperative, and that's why people feel that it is a good way to live, or one of several reasons why people feel it's a good way to live. But in fact, I think that most people are naturally creatures of attachment and encumberment, whether that be to physical objects, but also to personal relationships, which is another thing that declutterers counsel people to get rid of.
Yeah, I guess they're just nothing but burdens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they prevent you from engaging in sort of perpetual and total self-reinvention, which I think is the fantasy that all of these things are promoting in one way or another.
There's a history of religious people, saints, you know, who go off into the desert and commune with God and, you know, and have minimal interactions with the social world, the material world. But there does seem to be a religious grounding to this. It's mysterious to me how you could have a purely secular grounding to this kind of negation, undoing, emptying out.
Yeah, especially because it's sort of pure negation, whereas I think that religious ascetics aspire to be maximally encumbered in a way. It's just that they're encumbered with worship, or they're encumbered with God. They empty themselves out so that they can be filled with the sort of maximal substance. But there's no maximal substance in the metaphysics of the Marie Kondos of the world. It's purely negative.
Yeah, you have an essay on a suicide attempt when you were in college, and you were guided into cognitive behavioral therapy. The advice for that, suspend judgment, stop thinking. It seemed pretty odd to me to react to someone in suicidal emotional distress by saying, just stop thinking. A friend who had a concussion was once advised not to think. I don't really know how you can do this. How does one not think? How does one not judge? It just seems so instinctive to everything I do from minute to minute.
I had no gift. I had no gift for not thinking, which is why I kind of failed out of cognitive behavioral therapy and into a rich intellectual life.
But this leads you also to the mindfulness racket, which has its roots in Eastern religions, but a very banalized sort. It's not really clear what the point of all this is. Happiness? Ridding us of negative bummer energy? Could you review all this for us?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I will be limiting myself, and in the book, I kind of limit myself to talking about contemporary Western appropriations of these Eastern traditions. And one of the things that I say, and then a lot of sort of scholars of this have also argued, is that a lot of the practices that make sense in their institutional context, a lot of mindfulness practices that were developed to be performed by Buddhist monks in Buddhist temples in a Buddhist community, don't make a lot of sense when they're removed from that context, maybe in the same way that the kind of aesthetic religious practices of somebody like Marie Kondo don't make sense because she's not a medieval Christian mystic. They would make a lot more sense in that context. They would have more of a metaphysical grounding. That's what I'm talking about. I read a lot of books for this essay. I read, I don't know, 10, 15, 20. I've kind of suppressed the painful memories.
They all blur into a single sensibility, or are there differences among them?
There are very few differences among them. Much like the decluttering books, they're all so similar that they all use the same kind of phrases. I mean, it's a very formulaic genre. In order to be fair to CBT, I should say that CBT involves a lot of things, one of which is mindfulness. And so my gripe is really with mindfulness. It's not with some of the other things that I learned to do in CBT, which included sort of common sense, consoling things like leaving your house and going for a walk and sitting in a public space. But the kind of central injunction of the mindfulness people is to suspend judgment, not just temporarily when you're in the throes of kind of a manic or depressive episode, which is advice that I can see the wisdom in. A lot of these books say pretty explicitly that the goal is to live your life with mindfulness comprehensively, to suspend your judgment kind of for as much of the time as possible, and to watch your thoughts passing by as if they're clouds in the sky or some such.
Why? What's the point of that?
Well, I think that the original point of it and the most obvious point of it as a would be to distance yourself from intrusive negative thoughts when you're in the midst of some kind of mental crisis. And that makes sense to me. But I think that these people end up, by generalizing this method, they end up with this more comprehensive philosophy of selfhood that some of them explicitly defend. Sam Harris, for example, in his book about mindfulness, which I am able to remember as an individual book, he defends this, where the idea is that there is a you that is separate from your thoughts, and that is the authentic you, and it needs to be disentangled from your thoughts so that you can achieve some kind of authenticity and gaze on your thoughts impartially. That's the kind of picture of personhood that they're working with, and I think that it is a distorted picture of personhood, to say the least.
Yeah, what am I without my thoughts? I'm mystified.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly nothing but my thoughts. It's really a reflection on their thoughts and the quality of their thoughts that they want to be detached from them.
There seems to be this longing for a primal blank slate among this sort of tendency.
Yeah, I think that an allergy to history is a common tendency in the culture that I diagnose in different ways in different essays throughout the book. And the decluttering movement and this kind of very minimalistic, fragmented autofiction and the mindfulness movement, I think, all represent kind of an allergy to history and the encumbrance that it imposes upon us.
But you also give an example of somebody with a crappy job, and instead of thinking about your crappy job or maybe forming a union or trying to work politically to change the environment of crappy jobs, it's just, abandon your thoughts, abandon all judgment. It's a recipe for social detachment.
Oh, completely. I mean, and this is a sort of separate strain of critique that I have about the mindfulness books, is I was shocked by how in almost all of them, they would have an example of somebody who's in an unpleasant situation that they can't change, and they advise that person to perform mindfulness to kind of reconcile themselves to the unpleasant situation. And in almost all of them, the unpleasant situation was some kind of workplace injustice that is obviously the kind of thing that could be changed with political will and organizational capacity. And yet it's taken for granted in these books that the only thing that you can do if you have a bad boss or something is to engage in mindfulness and suspend judgment. And I think it's no accident that this is a methodology beloved in kind of corporate settings. One of the mindfulness books is by Arianna Huffington. So I recommend that one.
She has many charms. Yeah, this does sound like something the boss would approve of.
It definitely seems like a boss-approved methodology. I mean, I think that Arianna Huffington's book, if I recall correctly, it's now been like 2 years since I've read it, but like I think that she is in some ways the sort of most most obviously self-contradictory, because she acknowledges actually that there are kind of intractable economic problems. She's like, young people are stressed because they're looking for jobs, but there just aren't good jobs for them to have. And there's wage stagnation. And so they're kind of coming into a terrible economic landscape. So you think that maybe she's gonna actually concede that maybe they should do something about that, or that we should try to change the economic landscape, and then instead she just says that people should meditate.
A friend of mine worked with her in publishing in London way back when, 70s, early 80s, I can't remember exactly when, but her nickname was the most upwardly mobile Greeks in Sicarius. So
it sounds about right.
But, you know, she is a very ambitious sort for all that mindfulness.
You know, she's meditating herself to success. I mean, this is another thing that's quite characteristic of the mindfulness books, is that they all, on the one hand, say that the point of mindfulness is not to achieve worldly success. It does have these religious undertones. It's something that you undertake kind of for its own sake. It is the absence of striving or whatever. But then they also all make these really outrageous claims about the many ways in which it will improve your life. It will fix all of your health problems. It can cure everything, every disease that you could have, and it will make you a successful entrepreneur.
I'm speaking with Becca Rothfeld, author of All Things Are Too Small, just out in paperback from Metropolitan Books. I was struck when in your list of the classic works in the decluttering genre. I guess the first came out in 2007, then a bunch came out in the years just after, which is the time of the financial crisis and the Great Recession. It's like you don't really need that stuff. Capitalism is not delivering it to you anymore, so just embrace it as a form of enlightenment.
Yeah, that's sort of how I interpret this, is there's a great explosion in these kinds of books in 2008. And I mentioned in the book earlier that like IKEA kind of took off during an earlier recession.
Yeah, early 90s, right?
Yes, I think so. I have to look back.
Yeah, I think so it was.
The mid-century aesthetics that are very characteristic of IKEA, I also link with the aesthetics of the decluttering movement, because they have this vision for the rooms in your house as having kind of minimal furniture. The furniture that you have is not very ornamented, it's pretty plain. And so I think that it's probably no accident that that kind of aesthetic coincided with a recession initially and then kind of blew up again during an even worse recession.
Okay, well, they also save on manufacturing. They make you do all the work.
Yes, that's true. And it's also true of Marie Kondo. She makes you declutter your own house.
But she does have a handbook of methods, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. And if you're lucky enough or unlucky enough to appear on her show, then she'll come and declutter your house for you. But
is she still pursuing this racket?
The last I heard of her, she had children, and then she kind of gave up and accepted that it was impossible to have a tidy house when you have children.
Yes.
So I think she's kind of not doing anything anymore.
Oh, well, but she probably really pulled in the cash while it was the racket was at its peak.
I think so.
You had have a long essay on post-Me Too consent culture, which I thought was very interesting, and also gets into some of the post-liberals like Patrick Deneen. Deneen and people like him seem like theocrats, though they're quite evasive about it. Are these outlooks, which have some commonalities, fair to desire in its messiness and deeply human aspects? Nothing human is alien to me, as Marx liked to say, but not everyone seems to agree.
I think that a lot that is human is alien to both the post-liberals and the kind of sexual post-liberals. I call them the New Puritans in the book. And they're a group of people. The two people that I focus on are, one person is Louise Perry, who is kind of a reactionary anti-feminist writer about women's issues in the UK, and Christine Emba, who worked with me at the Washington Post for a time, then went to the Atlantic, and then is now at AEI, I believe. Their kind of vision is very structurally similar to the post-liberals' vision, is my claim. And both of these visions are very sanitizing. They try to eliminate the kind of mess and chaos from human life and interaction in a way that I find kind of repugnant.
Yeah, it's like just stay on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, and that most of the important questions about your life are or should be answered for you by kind of puritanical social organization. In the post-liberal vision, in the eyes of somebody like Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeule, I think that the idea is basically that the government is so intrusive that it's imposing socially conservative norms on you to the point where you don't really have the chance or capacity to devise your own vision of the good life and enact it. And I think that similarly for these kind of sexual conservatives, it's much the same. Their complaint is that there aren't enough guidelines and guardrails to keep sex unexciting and safe.
Well, it's all about the regulation of danger, too.
Yes, completely. And I mean, some of them say this, like David French, who I quote sort of repeatedly in irritation in the book, he had some essay where he said, you know, sex without love is a danger to human hearts. So they're pretty explicit about this, that they want to reinstitute an older set of sexual norms because they want to eliminate danger from romance and erotic encounter, which I think is not only impossible, but beside the point.
But there's also a left version of this.
Yes, there is a left version of this. It's certainly not as odious at all in any way. I do not wish to suggest that the leftists I'll mention are in any way comparable to the likes of Patrick Deneen, who I really find just appalling. But so I talk a little bit in the essay about Amiya Srinivasan's book, The Right to Sex, which I think is a really interesting book. She makes some of the same moves as some of the people who are on the right. Both of them think that consent is not the end-all be-all of sexual ethics. They're both tired of living in a world where we think that what you actually consent to is beyond moral appraisal, that the only relevant moral question about a sexual encounter is whether it was consensual. I think that feminists like Srinivasan and like myself, sometimes the concern is just that it's impossible to consent truly under patriarchal conditions, but I think that the objection can and should probably go further than that. It's that we should be talking about what is politically good sex beyond just the question of what people consent to. If you consent to like a highly patriarchal and repressive relationship, somebody like Amiya or somebody like me would say that's still bad because the content of the relationship is bad. But I think that Amiya Srinivasan's view, as far as I can tell what it is kind of the mirror image of the puritanical view, and that both parties see sex as a means to the end of something else. They see it as the means to the end of sort of political purity, although their visions for what political purity looks like is very different.
Disruptive delight does not figure in it, though.
No, it's a very dutiful thing. And there's a great book that I give a sort of long reading of called Acts of Service, which fleshes out novelistically what it would be like to adopt this view and to try to live it out, which to try to have sex dutifully.
So how do we get out of this world of very circumscribed desires, circumscribed ambitions, very limited horizons? Is there a way out of it?
I mean, I kind of think that we're always already out of it, to be a little bit annoying, to use the Heidegger vocabulary I spent years learning in grad school.
Oh, was that Heidegger? I thought it was Althusser, but
I think it's Althusser also, but Heidegger, je schon, as Heidegger says.
Okay.
Always already. I think that this is just a fanciful vision, and I think that the reason why conservatism ultimately breaks down, the reason why these kinds of regressive sexual norms can't really last, is because they're anathema to the way that sex actually is. As I argue in another essay in the book, which is about the director David Cronenberg, I think that sex is kind of, at its best anyway, is kind of a mutually transformative endeavor. You don't really know going into it how the other person is going to change and transform you. And so it's inherently unpredictable and chaotic and messy. And that's true even if you don't have sex. That's true of just falling in love. That's true of interacting with other people. So I think that all of these attempts to sanitize and order and organize human interaction are kind of just doomed to failure. It's one of several reasons why I think that a maximalist aesthetic is kind of on the way back.
J.D. Vance wouldn't approve, though.
No, he would not. And that's one of the many pleasures of this outlook.
That was Becca Rothfeld. Her book, All Things Are Too Small, was just out in paperback from Metropolitan Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Bella Bartok's Piano Sonata No. 1, performed by Martha Argerich. Till next week, bye.